Cyrus would come, Isaiah 44. Verse 28, he said of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, you shall be built. To the temple, your foundation shall be laid. He said, this is to my anointed, to Cyrus. So Cyrus is one of those few who was determined before his birth that he would be born, called by name well in advance. I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the two leave gates. So we see quite specifically a prophecy against Babylon and that he would take Babylon in chapter 45 of Isaiah. So we see the decree back in Ezra chapter 1 verse 2. Cyrus king of Persia said, the Lord God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth. He has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem and at Judah. Who is there among all of his people? His God be with him. Go to Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Build the house of the eternal God of Israel, for he is the God which is in Jerusalem. He is the God. From his perspective, he would be the God of Jerusalem. There was the belief then with syncretism that each god had a realm that they reigned over. So that Baal would be over his people in Babylon and in Assyria. Yahweh would be over Israel, which is part of the custom where they would take dirt. You know, let me take part of this earth and take it with them so that they could carry part of the land with them, feeling that God would be with them. So if you worshipped Yahweh, you would take some of that earth with you when you travel, and therefore the God of your land would be with you. Quite superstitious. I do not recommend that you carry little vials of sand with you when you leave campus. The expenses are paid in verse 4 by the king. Tie that in with chapter 6, verse 4. So some return, Judah, Benjamin, the Levites. At this point, it's about 42,000 comes to mind. Yes, chapter 2, verse 64. The whole congregation together that came back was 42,360. That's a congregation of Israel, and again, that's basically Judah, Benjamin, and those Levites that returned. And servants came with them, so that's an additional 7,337 in verse 65. So we have about 50,000 returning to the land. 50,000, you know, we think, oh, that's a lot of people. Well, Tyler is what, about 80,000? So, you know, about half, a little bit more than half of Tyler is the people that came back to Jerusalem and to the land of Judah. They did later encourage many others to come back. Most of those in Babylon were not eager to go back to Jerusalem. Realize we've got some time gap here from when they were taken, many of them back in 604, the time when Jeremiah and Daniel were taken, down to now we're talking 539, so what do we have there? We've got about 70 years. You're talking a good two, maybe three generations of births that have taken place. So grandma and grandpa have now died that were fairly old back in the time of the captivity. We will see that there are a few yet alive that saw Jerusalem, that saw the temple back in we could say that they were in about 590 to 597, 600 in that time period, that saw the first temple. That when the second temple is built, they're crying because it's not nearly the glory that the first was. So you do have some overlap of individuals, but for the most part, many of these have died. You've got then people that live over in Babylon that were comfortable. You know, this has now become their land. Their kids were born there. They're, you know, maybe some of their grandkids by this time. But they have a comfortable living. Cyrus was basically a nice king. He wasn't like the Assyrians and the Babylonians as they come in and just decimate everything. He wanted peace. His belief, and this is a major change in the concept of domination in world empires, and that is you dominate people by making them happy. And if they're basically happy, we're not saying that this is, you know, Disneyland or anything, or America, but if they're basically happy, then they're going to cooperate, and it's easier than on Cyrus. He doesn't have to worry about having too many troops in the land because the people, you know, what are they going to do? Where are they going to go? They know that any rebellion will be knocked down, and they're basically peaceable people. So most of those in Babylon stay. We have about 50,000 counting servants that come back over. We see in chapter 3 of Ezra, verse 1, when the seventh month was come, children of Israel gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem. There stood up Joshua, the son of Jozadak, his brother and his brethren, the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren. So we have Joshua, and we have Zerubbabel. Joshua, who is the priest. Zerubbabel, who is the civic leader, the civil leader. Many feel that this Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, is the same individual as Sheshbazzar in chapter 5, verse 14. Chapter 5, verse 14. Whose name was Sheshbazzar when he was made governor. There are some arguments for or against, and we're not going to take the time to go through those. So we find the seventh month was come. What does that bring to mind? What was happening in chapter 3? Fall holy day season. What is the first day of the seventh month on God's calendar? Feast of Trumpets is taking place. So they were come, they gathered together. The priests, obviously, the civil leader, they built an altar to the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings thereon, as is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. So they built an altar for worship. They kept also the Feast of Tabernacles, verse 4, as it is written, and offered the burnt offering by number, continual burnt offering, verse 5, both of the new moons, the set feasts of the eternal that were consecrated from the first day of the seventh month. So the first day is that of trumpets. Began they to offer burnt offerings. But the foundation of the temple of the eternal was not yet laid. An interesting sidelight for those who are in Epistles of Paul. We're going through 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, which talks about the man of sin. We got off talking a little bit today about the sacrifices in the future in Jerusalem. And precedence has been set. The Jews very avidly believe that they don't have to have a temple in order to sacrifice. And there is this proof in Ezra chapter 3 that they came to the land and all they had to do was to properly erect an altar in a place where they felt it would be dedicated to God, and to have the priests who were dedicated to properly offer the sacrifices. So when they come back to the land, they set up an altar and they start sacrificing immediately. They don't wait for the temple to be built. That is important, I think, in looking at prophecy in the future and the aspect of sacrifices. Will sacrifices be resumed? They could very easily be literally resumed. One of the big questions in prophecy is how much is figurative and how much is literal. Sacrificing to the Jews is not something that is lightly looked at and just figured as figurative. Oh, well, we'll just sacrifice our prayers to God. Well, we know that sacrifices were to be a picture of the death of Christ, as well as then, you know, the incense that was burnt with that of our prayers to God. But they take very literally the responsibility of sacrifice. And they were supposed to. I mean, they were to literally sacrifice on these days. So it's quite probable that they will again offer sacrifices in the future. All they need is an altar. All they need is the opportunity. They already have their schools which have taught how to properly do the sacrifices. They have made the utensils of sacrifice, they have them in Jerusalem now, and everything from that aspect is prepared. What they don't have is the Dome of the Rock, and they don't have the place, the holy place, in order to worship. There are theories that the northern part, which lines up with the eastern gate, which is to the north, just directly to the north of the Dome of the Rock, that that might be the place, and that that's the place where the old altar was, in the old temple. That's a theory. It would fit in quite well with leaving the Dome of the Rock right where it is if sometime in the future you had an individual that worked towards ecumenical agreement between Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, the three religions that revere Jerusalem. And if an individual, which we read a lot in Revelation 13 and 17 and 2 Thessalonians 2 and Book of Psalms mentions it several times, if you have an individual that puts these things together, then that could easily be done. They could then start sacrificing, which in turn could then lead to the sacrifices being stopped, which we read of in Daniel. Again, that's speculation. But I just bring it out from the aspect here that the precedence is set that all they need is an altar, and they would very readily start sacrificing. Of course, one of the other scenarios, possible scenarios, speculation, is that the Dome of the Rock would not exist from an errant scud or, you know, whatever else. As I was mentioning in class today, for as dumb as Saddam Hussein was, he was smart enough not to send any scuds very close to Jerusalem. Because if he were trying to bomb the Holy Sepulchre, for instance, which I dare say that he wouldn't mind bombing, since that stands for Christianity, or the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, it's awful close to the Dome of the Rock. And since they didn't exactly have pinpoint aim, and maybe he felt like the prayers of the Jews would be answered, because if they came close there at all, I'm sure the Jews would be praying that it would hit. Or, if they were going in Jerusalem, I dare say that someone, that the Jews would have attacked the Dome of the Rock, and they would look for an opportunity. They're looking for any excuse to blow that thing up. Not all Jews, but there are certain sects within the Jews. They have caught two or three different groups. There was a group back in the 70s that they caught with dynamite on the Temple Mount that were in the process of going there to blow it up. They also stopped digging underneath the Temple Mount because they were digging dangerously close to underneath the Dome of the Rock. So the Arabs claimed that the Jews were doing it so they could plant dynamite, blow up. In fact, if you're in Jerusalem, go up on the Temple Mount and try to walk to the southeast corner. The southeast corner. This is where it is the steepest precipice, and they believe, you know, maybe this is where Satan took Christ and said, you know, if you'll bow down and worship me, that I'll give you the kingdoms of the earth. It may be where some have been cast over, you know, and cast to their death at the bottom. It is very precipitous there, and if you could place a bomb at the very base of that, they believe that everything would slide down off the mountain. Now, some of this is superstition, and some of this, I suppose, is scientifically provable, that a big enough piece of dynamite or whatever type of weapon they would use, plastic explosives and whatever, it could take place. So, I mean, you know, we talk about it with, you know, all these scenarios and things could happen. Believe me, there are people trying to make these things take place because they have, you know, certain of these beliefs. It was the Al-Aqsa Mosque was bombed. That's that little silver-domed mosque at the base of, or at the south side of the Temple Mount, and that individual, unfortunately, was carrying a Plain Truth magazine with him when he did that, and therefore we got our names in the paper. He was not a member. He was not even a co-worker, as I understand the story. He just happened to have a Plain Truth magazine with him. All of that from Ezra 3. No extra charge. Okay, we pick up then verse 8 of Ezra 3. Now in the second year of their coming into the house of God at Jerusalem, so we're in 538 to 537, the second month, Zerubbabel and Joshua and those with him, they set forward to do the work of the house of the Eternal, so the work begins. Together they set forward the workmen to do the house of God, verse 10. The builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Eternal. They set the priests in their apparel, the trumpets, the Levites, the cymbals. I mean, so they have a lot of rejoicing here in verses 11 and in verse 12. Many of the priests and the Levites and the children of the fathers who were the ancient men that had seen the first house, when the foundation of the house was laid before their eyes, they wept with a loud voice, and many shouted for joy. Let's see where I have this in the outline. Under the first returnees, letter C, 537, the work on the temple began. The first foundation is laid. There were some attitude problems. The difficulties we find at 537, again going back, and this is what, within 50 years of the destruction of the temple, there were individuals that had seen the first, and boy, they moan and groan because the foundation itself shows them that this is not going to be as great as Solomon's. And they probably see some of the materials that are available for the building of it, and they know it won't be as great. So there is the hue and cry at this point. And a very negative attitude. But you read in the last part of verse 12, they wept with a loud voice, and many shouted aloud for joy. So there were many that were joyful just for the opportunity to worship in the temple. Maybe this is the younger generation, those who were looking forward to building a temple. There was the vigor of building a new house for God and to accomplish it. Is there a lesson from this? I believe the lesson is that sometimes those who have been around the longest cry the loudest and can sometimes defeat the attitude of worship, the attitude of vigor and enthusiasm. I think that's something for us to keep in mind as we get our education, we go on, you're around the church for a long period of time. Yes, there is some wisdom maybe that we're able to give out that, yes, let's be careful we don't set dates because we've done this before and we can recount how many times we have. On the other hand, there must be an enthusiasm for building the church and for accomplishing the goals that we have set out. And there was this huge clamor, so they couldn't even tell the noise of the joy from the noise of the crying. We pick up chapter 4 then, and we find there is opposition by the Samaritans to the building. Samaritans were those people to the north who had been, when Samaria was taken by Assyria, Samaria being the capital city of Israel, individuals from Assyria were brought over and they were placed then to dwell in that land. They intermarried with Israelites that were left behind as well as Jews, and therefore they could claim to have a Jewish background so that by the time of Christ, 500 years later, they would claim to be a Jew when it suited them and they would claim to be a Gentile when it suited them. So, I mean, they figured they could have the best of both worlds. At this particular time, it's early in the intermarrying leading up to that. So anyway, they were to the north and they wanted to get involved in the building. Chapter 4, verse 1. When the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity built the temple unto the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and said, let us build with you. Now, realize they were adversaries. In other words, they were part of the Assyrian culture that had been brought in to replace the Israelite culture. They were not worshiping like Judah, even though they had been marrying in to a degree with Judah. They wanted to build with them. For we seek your God as you do. Zerubbabel and Joshua viewed this as empty desire, or at least needing to prove itself. If they wanted to seek God, they could seek God, but not in helping to build the temple. Now, I think the fruits are born that Joshua and Zerubbabel made the right choice. They refused to let them build with them. Now, there would be some that would say, oh, well, if they'd allowed them to build with them, then they would have had this pluralism and everything would have been great. But they were against it because they felt that the Samaritans were seeking to join the Jews. Maybe they would therefore be able to infiltrate their beliefs, be able to access their beliefs with their own. They cried up, you have nothing, verse 3, you have nothing to do with us to build a house unto our God. We ourselves together will build the house of the eternal our God, as King Cyrus commanded us. So the Jews said, no, thank you, but no thanks. You know, I suppose they'd accept their contributions if they wanted, or, you know, bring food, whatever, but you're not going to actually build in the house of God. That's our job. That's our responsibility. What kind of analogies can we draw today? You know, as much as we would like to have endowments for the college, I think there are certain endowments that we would turn down. We're not going to let other religions, you know, Buddhist religion, decide to build one of the dorms and have it dedicated to them. No, we feel we have a job to do, and we're going to do it within the backing and the direction of God. So we find in verse 5, they hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, the king of Persia, until the reign of Darius, the king of Persia. So at this particular point, lawyers got involved. And the lawyers stopped the work of God. And we talked before, I think, in Amos about a famine of the word. A famine of the word could easily take place by the legal system deciding, hey, you can't do that. For whatever reason, at this particular point, they were just jealous, and they got their counselors, their lawyers, and they went to the king. They get things stopped. Verse 24. Again, there's some difficulties in chapter 4, but verse 24 really picks up with the story flow here. It says, then ceased the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, so it ceased until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So this is a restatement of what is said in verse 5. So verse 24, in 537, the work was stopped. And I've got those in the notes for you then on the handout. The next king that comes along rules from 530 to 522. His name was Cambyses. He ended up committing suicide. And with his suicide, there was an individual that came on the scene that claimed to be one of his sons, that we have two names for, Pseudo-Smerdis, pseudo meaning false, falsely of the line of Cambyses is the terminology, Smerdis, also known as Bardia. There was, within this time period, in 522 to 520, a civil war in Persia. And with the civil war, realize at any time wars took place, Judah was always looking for it to be Armageddon. You know, these prophecies that had taken place, this will be the one that the Messiah returns. And he will destroy, you know, he's going to destroy these kingdoms. He will be here. Return, I suppose, is the wrong word at that point. They're looking for the Messiah to come at this point. So we have the civil war from 522 to 520. Darius I then comes on the scene at 522 in the course of the civil war. Gets rid of Pseudo-Smerdis. We have political reorganization at this point, and we come to 520 to the prophecies of Haggai and Zechariah. Letter B there at the bottom of the page. 537 to 520, we have 17 years. Why is there a 17-year gap in the building of the temple? We're going to read in Haggai some of those reasons when we get to Haggai 1, verse 2, but we've stated it here. Apparently due to the persecution, because of the difficulties, because the lawyers came and they stopped the building, here was an excuse just to go by the law of the land. Now, there are other ways sometimes to get around the law, and that's to have a countersuit and to get to it. Well, for whatever reason, they didn't go to Cambyses from 530 to 522 to try to rebuild the temple. They just waited until finally the word of God, and they're in no, they have no interest at this point during the time of Darius of rebuilding the temple. But the word of Haggai and Zechariah come to them and says, how come you're sitting in your houses, fine houses you've built, nothing's happening on my building? So we see their hearts were lax towards the temple due to the persecution. Secondly, they were concerned more for self and for their homes and for what they were doing. Perhaps some of them were caught up with the attitude that Christ referred to of the man who was tearing down his barns to build bigger. You know, all kinds of money and all kinds of time on his hands now, so well, let's just build a bigger house. Let's remodel umpteenth time. I'm not against remodeling. I'm not against having a bigger barn if you need a bigger barn and if you're going to use that money wisely. 1 Timothy chapter 6 is a warning to those with wealth, and hopefully some of you will have wealth after you get out of college, you go out and get great jobs and you're going to be making six figures a year. Maybe it'll be a few years. Maybe it'll be mid five figures, whatever it is. God's lesson is, yes, you may have nice homes and whatever, but what do you use your wealth for? Do you use it for helping other people, for helping the poor, the needy, for educating the poor and the needy, with the, you know, through the work and through education? You know, those are factors to be considered. At this point, the people were not concerned for the work of God, which at that point would have been building a building for God, but they were more concerned for their own homes and what they were accomplishing. The third is they felt no need for Christ. They felt no need. There should be a comma there. For Christ would come anyway. In other words, why build a house for Christ? I mean, Christ is going to come. The Messiah is going to come. Why should we build him a house? Build his own house. You know, I don't know that he said that, but unfortunately that's the attitude it came across with. So we will then pick up, and what I want to do is for the remaining prophecies, Haggai and Zechariah, we're going to do it chronologically as they were written, so we can kind of get the flow of what took place when. So we cover most of Haggai, then we'll jog over to Zechariah 1. So you need to read Haggai 1 and 2 and Zechariah 1, and we will launch into that then on Wednesday.